We have two scripture readings today. The first one is Isaiah 39, until verse 1 to verse 8. At that time, Marduk-Baladan, son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent Hezekiah letters and a gift, because he had heard of his illness and recovery. Hezekiah received the envoys gladly and showed them what was in his storehouses, the silver, the gold, the spices, the fine olive oil, his entire armory, and everything found among his treasures. There was nothing in his palace or in all of his kingdom that Hezekiah did not show them. Then Isaiah, the prophet, went to King Hezekiah and asked, "What did these men say, and where did they come from?" "From a distant land," Hezekiah replied. "They came to me from Babylon." The prophet asked, "What did they see in your palace?" "Oh, they saw everything in my palace," Hezekiah said. "There is nothing among my treasures that I did not show them." Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord Almighty. The time will surely come when everything in your palace and all that your predecessors have stored up until this day will be carried off to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord. And some of your descendants, your own flesh and blood, who will be born to you, will be taken away, and they will become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." "The word of the Lord you have spoken is good," Hezekiah replied, for he thought, "There will be peace and security in my lifetime." The second reading comes from Matthew, chapter 13, 44 to 46. "The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then, in his joy, went and sold all he had and bought that field." Again, "The kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it."
Everyone loves a good story. Everyone loves a good story. I heard a good story yesterday in a kind of unexpected place, watching the ball game. And if you're a baseball fan, you know that this series that's happening in Toronto this weekend is big. Blue Jays, Boston Red Sox. And so I saw something in the background that I thought was a great story. Boston Pizza changed their name to Toronto Pizza in Toronto yesterday. Like, isn't that a good story? That's awesome. I love it. There are stories everywhere, all around us. James Brian Smith writes that we are creatures who live by our stories. From early on, we are told stories by our parents, which help us interpret how life is, or how life ought to be. And so I started thinking about the kinds of stories that I, as a parent, tell my kids. There are a lot of them, but the first few that came to mind, there's the one about baseball and how it is a superior sport. So I make sure that this is a story that is told in our household. There's the one about cleanliness and how you cannot let your laundry continue to pile up all around the house. There's the one about other people, like when Jude found out that there was a new kid in his class this year, and we talked about the importance of being there and trying to let that kid fit in and be a friend to him. There's the one about education, which we usually tell when we drive by the guy holding the Little Caesars pizza sign on the street corner. Now, some of these parenting stories take root, while others fall on deaf ears. But most of them will probably rock back and forth somewhere in between, being evaluated by our kids until hopefully the best of them, the most important of them, are internalized. But it's not just parents that are telling stories, and it's not just children who are hearing them. We're all being told stories, and pretty much all of the time. Like the one about church. Our culture has a story about church, that it's a thing of the past, that it's something for a grandparents' generation, that it's full of hypocrites, that all they do is want your money. We're going to talk about that story next week. Or there's a story about sex, that it's a great way to feel good, that it has nothing to do with a lifelong commitment between a husband and a wife. We'll talk about that story next month. In fact, for the next 2 months, we're going to be unpacking these and other favorite cultural stories, holding them up against the narrative of what God is doing in our world, to see how well or how poorly our culture's stories match up. Alistair McIntyre writes, "I can't answer the question, what ought I to do, unless I have already answered a prior question of which story am I a part? If we're not aware of the narratives that are giving shape to our lives, then there's no way for us to critique and evaluate them. There's no way for us to get out from under them or to ensure that their anchors are sunk deep into the fabric of our being. We're going to take a look at how some Old Testament prophets speak to our own culture stories and how the life and teachings of Jesus introduce a powerful meta-narrative, a story for all stories, a story that encompasses all of the other ones around us. A few verses prior to the passage from Matthew that Teresa read for us, Matthew comments on Jesus' approach to teaching. He says Jesus spoke all of these things to the crowd in parables, basically short stories. He did not say anything to them without using a parable. So was fulfilled what was spoken through the prophet, "I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things hidden since the creation of the world." Well, we're going to listen in to some of the things that Jesus has to say and see what they have to do for our lives. Because he told stories, because stories stick. But which ones have stuck to us? Now, the reading from Isaiah comes to us from the 7th century B.C. Isaiah was a prophet, and in this particular instance, he's having a conversation with Hezekiah. I got an email from Melissa Malik, a member of our community, and she was talking about her role working with students on campus here in Waterloo, and she was doing some research into the role of a prophet and had this great definition. A prophet is someone who speaks the truth of God into the truth of the culture of the day. And so that's what Isaiah was trying to do, speak God's truth into the truth of the culture of his day and challenge it. So when we meet King Hezekiah, he is through the roof excited to show off all of the treasures of his kingdom to an envoy sent from Babylon. And maybe when we're hearing this passage, we're like, I don't really know what's going on. But the same thing happens regularly. In fact, just 2 weeks ago, our prime minister went to China on a trade mission. It's basically the same thing. They literally rolled out the red carpet for him, not figuratively. They literally rolled out the red carpet, and they showed off their treasures, right? Like, take a look at our big wall. You know, you don't have anything like this in Canada, do you? And so it's the same kind of thing. Hezekiah's like, hey, check out all my stuff. Check out all the riches and all the good things that we have going on here. Now, what's a little surprising is that in the previous chapter, King Hezekiah had overcome a life-threatening illness. And he's still somehow focused on these material things. 15 years ago today, when two airplanes crashed into the World Trade Center, just about everyone in North America paused to consider what mattered most in life. I think anyone probably 25 years or older in this room remembers exactly where you were and exactly how it felt to hear that kind of news. And I can remember, too, in the weeks and months that followed, the talk about the kind of effect that a disaster like this would have on North American culture. That the effect would be a spiritual awakening, because church attendance was actually kind of spiking afterwards, and people were being generous and giving, and people thought this is going to lead to a great spiritual awakening kind of in our generation. And certainly there are lingering effects from this tragedy, even 15 years later, but I think that initial spike in curiosity, it waned pretty quickly. Because there are other stories that were even more powerful than the story of September 11th. Jamie Smith writes, "It is because we carry a story in our bones that we comport ourselves to the world in certain ways. We live the way we live because there's a story that drives us. And even an event like September 11th wasn't enough to change the way that people would live their lives." Now, to be fair, earlier in his reign, the Bible tells us that Hezekiah trusted the Lord, that there is no one like him among all the kings of Judah, either before him or after him. His response to Isaiah's prophetic words, though, was one of complacency. Isaiah basically says, this whole country of yours, your descendants, you're all in trouble. And his response was to say, well, there will be peace and security in my lifetime. Too bad for those guys. Too bad for everyone else, but I'm going to be okay. So this is a good word. His vision of the good life had nothing to do with how others would be affected by his actions or what he would pass on to the next generation. Now, the Bible tells us two things that Hezekiah would be remembered for. The first is that all his achievements and how he made the pool and the tunnel by which he brought water into the city, that was one thing he'd be remembered for. And the second, that Manasseh, his son, succeeded him as king. But the problem is the story he was living by kind of laid both of these things to waste. because all of the people who were enjoying the water brought to the city by that tunnel were exiled into Babylon. And the son who succeeded him as king, Manasseh, became one of the most wicked kings in history. But as far as Hezekiah was concerned, he was living the good life. He had health and wealth, and that was about all that mattered. I want to read a passage that comes from Jamie Smith's book, Desiring the Kingdom. He writes, "Our ultimate love is oriented by and to a picture of what we think it looks like for us to live well. And that picture then governs, shapes, and motivates our decisions and actions. Thus, we become certain kinds of people. We begin to emulate, mimic, and mirror the particular vision that we desire. Attracted by it and moved toward it, we begin to live into this vision of the good life and start to look like citizens who inhabit the world that we picture as the good life. We become little microcosms of that envisioned world as we try to embody it in the here and now. So many of the penultimate decisions, actions, and paths we undertake are implicitly and ultimately aimed at trying to live out the vision of the good life that we love and that we want to pursue." In other words, whatever vision of the good life we accept, it captivates us, and it stirs up our hearts to seek after it with everything we have in us. So I was thinking about how we might define the good life according to the world that we live in today, at least our part of the world that we live in. And I thought the good life is graduating from university, traveling the world, finding a partner, getting married, having children, buying a house, excelling in your career, sending your kids off to university so they can begin the good life, retiring young, and eventually dying in your sleep at a ripe old age. That is the good life, right there. Now, most of the people we know, and quite possibly most of the people in this room, would sign up for that story without a moment's hesitation. I'll take one. Sounds good to me. Of course, not all of us would. Some of us have different ideas of what the good life is, but do you agree that it's pretty much the default story in our culture? It's pretty much the story that's told out there. Now, this story begins when high school ends, so I got to thinking about the story that our junior and senior youth are told about the good life. And I think it's a story where you have lots of friends, where you experience things for the first time, where people find you attractive, where you make the team, and of course, where you get lots of likes on your Instagram posts. That's kind of the beginning of the good life, and then it kind of blends into the other one. Jamie Smith says, to be human is to be animated by and oriented towards some vision of the good life, some picture of what we think counts as flourishing. It's not a question of whether you long for some version of the kingdom, but of which version you long for. So as good of a vision as this might be, if this is what we're focused on, like Hezekiah, it will prevent us from pursuing something more. Well, let's turn then to a pair of very simple stories that Jesus told his first followers to challenge their satisfaction with the dominant cultural narrative of the day. Matthew 13:44, "The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field." Now, has anyone here dug up any buried treasure lately? Probably not. Except I know one person who has, and that's Luke Swinson. I was talking to him this week, and he actually spent his summer, like, digging up buried treasure. Like, that was his job. He was doing, like, an archaeological digs east of Toronto, making sure that they weren't going to be developing over culturally sensitive lands. I was like, you actually spent your summer digging for treasure. Yeah. Found all kinds of pre-settlement, like, you know, artifacts, and I'm like, man, that's a job to keep. You know, not unsimilarly, in lands that were subject to raiding forces as Palestine was, in Jesus' day, people would often resort to burying valuables in hopes of a future recovery. So as they heard about people coming in to take over their land, they would bury things that mattered, and hopefully this is just temporary and we can come back and find it. So the man in Jesus' story, he drives his spade into the ground and voila, he finds something that someone had buried, thinking that one day they would come back to their land. But his discovery required a sacrifice. He had to sell everything he had to purchase that plot of land that the treasure was buried on. That's a lot to ask. But in Jesus' story, it was in his joy that the man sold all he had. It wasn't out of guilt. It wasn't due to peer pressure. It wasn't begrudgingly. You know, I was thinking about the song that Eric introduced this morning, I surrender all. And I'm thinking, how does this sound to people here this morning? This is like, surrender? Are you kidding me? There's no way. But this message isn't about, you know, being pushed into giving something up. This man, in his joy, gave up everything he had because he knew he found something worth more. So there's a second story that Jesus tells, verse 45 and 46. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. So it's a similar story, but in this version, it's not an accidental discovery. He doesn't just come across something accidentally. This man had actually been looking for fine pearls. He'd been looking for something valuable. It was an intentional search and his result. Sometimes we come across opportunities and we had nothing to do with it, but other times we actually really commit ourselves to finding something and we end up finding it. Baxter Kruger writes, "Without God, we will never find our resolution, and thus the life for which we are searching. But the way he's been portrayed in the Western world keeps us from even suspecting that God might be the answer to the passion of our hearts. We're searching, we're looking, but we're told, according to the story around us, that we can't find that answer in God. And yet there are people here this morning who have a strong suspicion that there is more to life, and that just maybe a church like this might be the place to find what you're looking for. It's not a new longing. This isn't something that just started to happen in the 21st century. This isn't something that only happens in North America. In the 4th century, one of the early church leaders, St. Augustine, writes, "You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." We are created for God, and so we will always be longing and searching and looking until we come across God himself. And when you find your rest in God, you find more than some treasure or some fine pearl. Of course, that's what Jesus was saying. You find a reason for living. You find an orienting story for your life. So as Jesus points out in these briefest of stories, there's something out there that is worth more than whatever else you already have. Now think about the good life summary that I rattled off earlier, all those things that sound so appealing to us. Jesus says that when you discover the kingdom of heaven, you're willing to give all of that away in exchange. Everything you've gathered up until now, you're willing to let go of it all because of what you've discovered. And it's not like the characters in these short stories had nothing. They actually had quite a lot. One man had a lot, enough to buy a whole field. The other person had enough to buy this valuable pearl. It's just that what they had didn't end up being the best that could be had, and they knew the exchange was worth it. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that you can't have one without the other. I'm not saying that it's either university or Jesus. Children or Jesus. My goodness, if it's children or Jesus, our church is in trouble. Right? No, this isn't like the things that our culture says are good, you have to like abandon them or turn your back on them and follow. That's not what I'm saying. They're not always mutually exclusive. But what I am saying is that it's either Jesus' vision of the kingdom, which may just happen to include university and children, or it's our cultural's vision, full stop. Because our culture's vision certainly doesn't include pursuing God as an answer to the passion of our hearts. Eugene Peterson explains what I'm trying to say well. He says that Jesus is not interested in diverting us from life, but in revealing the more that is in life beyond what we can cobble together on our own. Christian faith, Christian spirituality isn't about like turning our back on everything that we think is good. It's about understanding that God needs to be the orienting passion for all of those good things, and maybe some new good things that we haven't thought about to this point. If we start with the kingdom, then whether we go to university or not, whether we raise children or not, even whether we get lots of likes on Instagram or not, we are still able to live the good life that God has defined for us. So I thought of a story that illustrates this well, I think, for me. So back in the spring, our family traveled to Ireland as part of a sabbatical leave that I was on. And when we got there, we got a rental car. And I don't know if you've ever driven, like in Ireland or in the UK. Things are a little different if you've done that. Now, first of all, here's the first thing that's different. That is a two-lane street. Two lanes. Like, that's insane. It's like the width of a parking space. And so everywhere you drive, like, that's a challenge. But the real challenge of driving in Ireland was that everything is backwards, right? So the next slide shows this little warning sign in the front of the car, drive on the left. So you have to drive on the left side of the street, which is weird. And you have to sit on the right side of the vehicle, which is weird. And you have to change gears with your left hand, which is weird. All of this together is like, driving is this simple thing that I do every day, that is easy and normal. But all of a sudden, I'm doing all the same things I do. I'm looking at a traffic signal, I'm changing lanes, I'm applying the brake, I'm changing gears, but it's all different. I'm doing all the same things, but I'm doing them all differently. Most of what I did was the same, but I did it from a different starting point. I don't know why we decided to go straight from the airport into downtown Dublin, but we did, and I can remember sitting there on the right side of the car, and Owen was sitting on the left-hand side, and he kept yelling at me because I was about to hit the car beside me or the person on the sidewalk or the street sign or whatever. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Because judging the difference, sitting on the right side of the car, judging the distance to the left side of the vehicle was very different than sitting on this side, judging the distance this way. So again, sitting in a similar place, but all of a sudden you change your seats and things look different. All of a sudden your perspective changes and there's an adjustment that needs to be made. Now, when I was there, I thought, well, if I want to get along in Ireland, if we want to get anywhere here, I've got to figure this out. I've got to just kind of deal with it, make the adjustment, and go about my way. If I want to get along in the kingdom of God, I've got to figure this out. I've got to figure out how to do kind of the same things that I do every day. Go through the same seasons and same kind of goals that are out there in life. And I've got to figure out how to navigate life, but do it from a different seat. Do it from a different perspective. Do it from a different vantage point. I've got to figure this out if I want to live life in the kingdom the way that God has portrayed it. I want to read from James Brian Smith's book, The Good and Beautiful God, brief commentary on stories. He says, we are shaped by our stories. And I'm just going to invite those who are serving communion to come on up at this point. We are shaped by our stories. In fact, our stories once in place determine much of our behavior without regard to their accuracy or helpfulness. Once these stories are stored in our minds, they stay there, largely unchallenged, until we die. And here is the main point. These narratives are running and often ruining our lives. That is why it is crucial for us to get the right narratives. What we're looking for is a story that seeps deep into our bones and becomes the orienting background of our being in the world. While the story of the good life that we tend to hear primarily has to do with accomplishments, and that it almost entirely revolves around us, the story that Jesus tells, the one about the kingdom of heaven, is about waking up to the reality that we live in a world infused with the presence of God, accepting his invitation to live every moment in relationship with him, and allowing him to shape and form us into the kinds of people who will experience the fullness of life that he created us to enjoy. As Jesus' parables about the treasure and the pearl remind us, we've been able to recognize the value of this opportunity, and we need to act on it. And we need to act on it now. So I'm going to close this morning with another good story. It's a story about how Jesus wasn't just talking. He wasn't just saying, if you find something really valuable, you got to be able to give up what matters the most to you. It's a story about how Jesus did that exact thing. See, the thing that he found, the treasure that he found in the field, the pearl of great price that he found, was us. It was humanity. And he had to give up everything to buy it. He gave up his life. And in communion, we remember this story because Jesus asked us to remember it. He gathered around on the night he was betrayed with his closest followers, and he passed this piece of bread around the table, and he says, I want you to do this, the same thing we're doing right now. I want you to do it in remembrance of me. I want you to remember that my body was broken for you. And then he did the same thing with a cup, and he passed it around that table. And he said, I want you to do the same thing that we're doing now in remembrance of me, remembering that I am starting a new covenant with you in my blood, and that there's forgiveness because of what I'm about to do for you. It's a story where Jesus said, I have found something worth giving my life for. And he did that. And he did it for each one of us. So this morning, we're going to celebrate in communion. I'd invite you to come, whether this is something you look forward to every month or whether you've never walked this aisle to do this before. This is an open table. And we invite you to come and to take these elements with you back to your seat. And then once everyone has had an opportunity to come around the table, we'll pray together and we'll share, remembering the story of what Jesus has done for us and remembering the invitation that he's invited us into. So come as you are.